Good afternoon. You are tuned to a Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 6th of October, the year 2015. Jeff Brown with you here today. We're going to update on library activities with guest Beth Weigel. We'll learn about the Family Promise Interfaith Hospitality Network. We'll talk with Tom Brennan about his new book, Dead Man's Dancer, the Michelle Linnan story. We'll also talk with Sarah Radke Brown about the Empty Chairs Project. That Writer's Almanac, very known music and more today on the Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with patchy fog later on. Low temperatures 36 to 42 degrees with light winds. Forecast for Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. High temperatures around 53 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A hearing opened Monday re-examining the convictions of a group of men known as the Fairbanks Four for the 1997 beating death of John Hartman. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Alaska Natives George Fries, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, and American Indian Kevin Pease were convicted of killing John Hartman by two juries in two separate trials, but their case has long been plagued by allegations of subpar forensics, coerced confessions, unreliable witnesses, and even racism. Fairbanks Four supporters rallied outside the courthouse where attorneys led by the Alaska Innocence Project introduced a key witness. William Holmes, a man serving double life sentences for other killings, says a group of his friends, not the Fairbanks Four, beat John Hartman in a random attack. Testifying Monday, Holmes describes himself as the driver who dropped off three friends who ran out of sight after Hartman, then returned a few minutes later in an agitated state.
And I was asking them, what happened? And they just kept saying, little Jay was tripping. He stomped him out. So I looked over at Jason Wallace, and I said, man, what happened? And he was just kind of just looking like he didn't even say anything. He was just in the zone, kind of looking forward, didn't respond.
Holmes' former friend, Jason Wallace, who's also serving life for an unrelated murder, told a public defender agency employee about the incident in 2003, claiming he was just the driver, a recently unveiled rendition of the story that will come up later in the month-long hearing. State prosecutor Adrian Bachman acknowledges new evidence in the case, adding she also plans to bring forward witnesses, including an Alaska Native cab driver who says she saw the Fairbanks Four near where Hartman was found dying in the snow.
And she describes the unusual haircut of Kevin Pease, the face of Marvin Roberts, and the elusive or evasive action of two other boys who she perceives are Native or Asian.
Bachman says the witness, who may appear later in the hearing, describes feeling a catch in her spirit, knowing something was amiss. I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
The U.S. Supreme Court denied an appeal Monday from the Sac and Fox Nation and Sons of Jim Thorpe to relocate the sports star's remains from Pennsylvania to Oklahoma. Jacob McClellan of KGOU has more.
After Jim Thorpe's death in 1953, his widow removed his body during his Sac and Fox burial ceremony in Oklahoma, then reached a deal to bury him in the Pennsylvania town that bears his name. The tribe and Thorpe's surviving sons sued to return his remains through the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, but the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled NAGPRA doesn't apply in what it called a family dispute. Sandra Massey is an historic preservationist with the Sac and Fox Nation. She says the Supreme Court's decision is disappointing.
I really honestly believe if somebody looked at that case, read that case, and understood it, that they would have heard it.
An attorney for the tribe says the Supreme Court's denial will end legal efforts for repatriation of Thorpe's remains through NAGPRA for the time being. The 1990 law requires cultural items such as human remains and sacred objects be returned to descendants and tribes. University of Oklahoma law professor Lindsay Robertson says even though the high court's refusal will close the door on this particular version of the case, he thinks the court of public opinion could still play a role.
I think as more and more people become aware, that's bound to have some sort of an impact on the resolution of the case.
Jim Thorpe won the gold medal in the pentathlon and the decathlon in the 1912 Olympic Games in Stockholm. He later played professional football and baseball and is a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I'm Jacob McClelland in Norman, Oklahoma.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to listener-supported KTUO and KRNN FM in Juneau. In the studio with me now is Beth Weigel. Beth, thanks for coming down the station with me today.
Thanks, Jeff.
So you're going to talk about the new library and a bunch of other things, but let's talk about that 15-minute tour.
Yeah. So, it was great. We had Matt Miller out there the other day, and I gave him a tour. And so if you haven't been out to the library yet, you can always take the virtual tour on your KTOO website. But I'm encouraging everyone to come on out to our new Valley Library, located right next to the Diamond Park Aquatic Center in that Diamond Park area. And we're open and ready for business. We're still tweaking a few things here and there, but our hours are the same as they used to be at the Mendenhall Mall. So that's Monday through Thursday, 10 to 5. Then on Friday, 10 to 8. Monday through Thursday, 10 to 7 on Friday, 10 to 6 on Saturday, and 12 to 5 on Sunday. So same hours, same phone number, so you can still count on that information. And we are taking books, bring back your books, we'll check them in, come check out a lot of the new features of the New Valley Library. We've got the teen room, which I know is very exciting. We've had lots of young people coming over from Thunder Mountain during lunch and different times during the day to check out the teen room, where we'll be getting the gaming station up and going here very soon, so that'll be lots of fun. And also our new computers that we have, our public computers for sitting down and doing work, now all have Minecraft on them. So that's another new feature, as well as if you have a library card, you can use those computers for up to 2 hours a day, and now they'll be in 60-minute installation times instead of 30 minutes. And if you get a guest pass from the circulation desk, you can use those computers for an hour.
If you want to get your own library card.
Yeah, you want to get your own library card for sure. And if you do want to try and come in and get a library card, you need to bring in some form of identification with a picture on it. And it should have your current local address on it. If it doesn't have your current local address on, bring in a piece of mail that shows your current local address on it. And if you don't have that yet, we can send you a postcard so you can get a postcard that has your current local address on it, and then you bring that in, and we'll set you up with a new library card.
I'm not sure what I like better, the art or the reading nooks.
The art is amazing. We are so happy with how everything turned out, and I think the swans are just beautiful. If you come in on a day like today when the sun is out and light is streaming into that library, it's very open feeling. You really can just imagine those swans going right on out the windows and heading towards Thunder Mountain or something like that. So that's really amazing. The bodies are crafted to be about life size, so it gives you that sense of how large those creatures really are. And, of course, their fanciful book wings is a nice addition for our library. And the Aurora Project art in the children's area is also amazing. It was a vinyl mask, so, you know, the mask was laid down and then peeled off in a way that then you could paint and then peel that off again. So that's really been a wonderful addition to it. It gives such a nice feeling of being in there. This morning we had our first toddler time, yesterday morning we had our first toddler time there, and it's a great picture having all the kids there and parents and everybody with that great artwork in behind. So it's just a beautiful space. The bricks outside, the nooks, the reading nooks are a great addition to the children's area as well. You can climb in there and snuggle on in and read away.
And if you missed getting out there to see it live, look on KTOO's website, because it's really some fantastic.
Some great photographs that Matt Miller took when he was out there on that beautiful day. So, yeah, so come on out. Just come out to check it out. Of course, we'll have our grand opening celebration on November 7th, and we'll have all sorts of groups there helping welcome everybody to the library, some Tlingit dancing groups and music and food and all sorts of activities to check out the space and celebrate the ribbon cutting of the new building. It'll be a wonderful day at the library on November 7th. That's a Saturday.
Have you thought of anything that you could do at the new library that you couldn't do in the old library?
Well, there's lots of things I think you can do in this new library. The spaces that we have available for the public's use is just a great addition. We only have the one conference room in the old Menin Hall Mall, and now we've got a large conference room that can seat up to 70 people when the doors are closed and the meeting room's closed off, but even more if we leave it open. And there's two different ways to connect in to project up onto the large screen or with the Online with Libraries video conferencing system. That screen is huge, so it's a much bigger space for movie viewing. We'll be holding some great programming out there with the science on the screen in the future here, where we have a speaker paired up with a film, and the speaker will talk a little bit about the science behind the film and things like that. So we'll be adding a lot of sort of movie-type events out at the Valley Library, and it'll just be a great space for just bigger group gatherings. Then we also have the small conference room, and then we have four study areas. So if you're working with a group of people trying to just have a small group, and maybe you've got something that you all need to see, each one of those rooms has a screen that you can connect to. It's got the big whiteboards, and those are available to sign out for up to 2 hours in a day, and either the day of or a week or so in advance. So lots of more places to meet and gather and just spend some time. And just having the views and things like that are just a huge addition to the library world.
And I imagine you've been keeping busy doing other stuff at the same time.
That's right. So we've still kept up with a lot of our programming. We've had a little bit of a change in some of our programs that because of the new library. And first and foremost, we've had ongoing here for the last month our bookmark contest. So our deadline for the bookmarks to come in is Thursday, October 15th. So keep making your bookmarks and bringing those in or sending them in through your teacher. And then that same day, Thursday, October 15th, we're going to have the baby fair. And that's what we're calling, that's the third Thursday of the month. And we've always had a partnership with the AEYC, the Association for the Education of Young Children, to put on a sort of a preschool family night, and that was in the past the first Tuesday of the month, but that now we've changed to become the third Thursday of the night. So we're kicking off this month a little bit differently with the baby fair, and that'll be out at the New Valley Library from 3 to 6 p.m., and it'll be local experts and families, and they can learn more about baby development, birth support, child care questions. There'll be free hearing and vision screenings, flu shots, how to take care of you, sleeping like a baby, family-friendly activities, door prizes, all kinds of things. And we're really encouraging families of expectant families and children of ages 0 to 2. It's in partnership with AEYC and Partnerships for Families and Children and the Juno Community Foundation Hope Endowment, as well as THREAD. So lots of people put their hats in to make this event happen. And then the ongoing programming that will happen each month successively after this baby fair on the third Thursday of the night will be the preschool family night in conjunction with AEYC. And then our family nights that we did in the Menin Hall Valley, which were on that third Thursday usually, are now on the first Thursdays of the month. So we just had one here the other night downtown, and we'll do those downtown. And so we've just sort of flip-flopped the locations for those and changed the day, so that's a little confusing, but you can always give us a call if you're confused. But the baby fair will be happening on October 15th, and then from then on, the family time or family nights with the AEYC. A reminder that we'll also be closed on Alaska Day on the 19th of October, and then we've got a couple other things going on. A pop-up museum program at the Douglas Library on Saturday, October 24th. It'll be Ordinary Things, Extraordinary Tales. So any community member of all ages can bring in some ordinary object that triggers them to tell an interesting story and share it. So we'll have an hour and a half or so. We'll create the museum exhibit, visit the different displays people have put up, share some refreshments, and then we'll take it all down and go home. So that's pretty great. Another partnership or part of the museum's exhibits will be out at the New Valley Library. The empty chair and World War II display is out at the New Valley Library, and then it'll move over to the Douglas Museum, it'll be out there at the Valley, right? And then over in the Douglas Library, we'll have this pop-up museum happening. So lots of things that we're doing in conjunction with the museum.
And is all this information online?
Yes, all this information's online. And then at the end of the month, we'll be at the Klan Conference doing our StoryCorps at Your Library project, the oral history project, where we're engaging folks to tell Alaska Native educational experience stories. So we'll be there the end of the month from the 29th to the 31st at Centennial Hall. So that's another opportunity to come and learn a little bit more about the StoryCorps program.
As usual, a lot of great things going on at the public library.
That's right.
Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just you can find us on Facebook, or you can check out our website, or you can give us a call.
Beth Weigel, thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 6th of October, 2015. It's the birthday of the spy novelist Joseph Finder, born 1958 in Chicago, but lived all over the world. His first language was Farsi, which he learned as a boy in Kabul, Afghanistan. Went to Yale, majored in Russian studies, went to work for the CIA, then wrote a nonfiction expose called Red Carpet about ties between the Kremlin and some powerful American businessmen. First novel was The Moscow Club in 1991. It was on this date, 1945, a Greek tavern owner in Chicago named William Cyanis was thrown out of Wrigley Field in Chicago for trying to bring a goat to a game. It was the World Series, and the Chicago Cubs were up 2-1 over the Detroit Tigers. Cyanis had a tavern across the street from the ballpark. He thought the goat would bring the team good luck, so he bought 2 tickets, one for him, one for the goat, whose name was Murphy. They wouldn't let him into the ballpark because they said the goat stinks, and according to legend, William Cyanis then cursed the team. The Cubs went on to lose the next 3 games, and they have not appeared in a World Series ever since. It was on this date, 2007, that Jason Lewis and the Expedition 360 team completed the first entirely human-powered trip around the world, traveling on human power alone, no help from motors, animals, or even sails to capture the wind. They didn't do it all at once. It took them, in fact, more than 13 years to accomplish this. Set off from Greenwich, England, July 12, 1994, pedaled a boat across the English Channel, bicycled through France, Spain, and Portugal, then crossed the Atlantic Ocean, which took 111 days, landed in Miami, biked and skated across the continental United States. Jason Lewis had to stop and earn money at various times, worked at cattle ranches, funeral homes. About a year into the expedition, he was rollerblading on a Colorado road when he was run over by a drunk driver, both of his legs broken, one almost amputated, spent 6 weeks in the hospital, 9 months recovering before he could resume his trip around the world. Many mishaps. He was arrested in Egypt as a suspected spy, came down with malaria, had 2 hernia operations, was robbed once. And finally, on this day, in 2007, he returned to Greenwich. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly entitled Nailing a Dock Together. The dock is done, pulled out in the lake. How I love putting my wet foot on the boards I sawed myself. It is a ladder stretching back to land. So many secrets are still hidden. A walker digs up a tin box with secrets and then joyfully buries it again so that the night and day will remain fresh. The horse stands penned, but is also free. It is a horse whose neck human beings have longed to touch for centuries. He stands in a stable of invisible wood. A poem by Robert Bly, Nailing a Dock Together, from Like the New Moon, I Will Live My Life, published by White Pine Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by TIAA Cref, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA Cref, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Starting 1 minute past the hour, you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. You're on a beautiful Tuesday. In the studio with me next is Terry Sage Harvey. She's the pastor at Shepherd of the Valley Church. She's here to talk about the Family Promise Interfaith Hospitality Network. Terry, thanks for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So, tell me, what is the Faith Promise Interfaith Hospitality Network?
It is a long name. Family Promise is actually a national program going on for 25 years where it uses church buildings, congregational buildings, to help provide hospitality for families in transition. Instead of building shelters for families, it's like we use buildings that are already existing. And then you also have a volunteer kind of family to help surround families during a very traumatic, challenging time. So for about a year, we've been working on getting an affiliate going here in Juneau. One of the things as a pastor, I realized I get that phone call saying my family has been kicked out, evicted, can't just moved up, can't find a place. What can we do? And there aren't many choices. Right now, St. Vincent de Paul has 120 folks on their waiting list, and they are the only family shelter, I believe, in town. So it's a pretty overwhelming problem, challenge. The school district counts about 165 homeless youth. So we said, we have plenty of church buildings, if you haven't noticed, in Juneau, and we can use those to help provide this gap and support for families. So we've been recruiting congregations, having conversations with members and leadership about 4 weeks out of the year. They would provide dinner, a place to sleep, and breakfast for families. We are looking for a day center. We will organize a day center where families can go and shower and prepare for work or school, and do whatever kind of vocational things they need to. It is a phenomenal program with great statistics for placing families into permanent housing. So we're excited to see it getting organized here in Juneau. But we really want to get the word out. So the big thing that's coming up is this Sunday. Randy Sutek from Randy's Rib Shack has agreed to do a pulled pork dinner for us. So he'll smoke it and have his barbecue sauce and beans and whatever else, buns, coleslaw, all that good stuff, at Chapel by the Lake from 4:30 to 6:30. And we'll have lots of information about what Family Promise is. It's a great time for us to kind of calm some of the fears. This is not a drop-in program. It's not just opening the doors of churches to let people sleep there. It's a very well-organized program with an executive director who will screen families and work with them to make sure that we're not asking too much of our volunteers. So it's a publicity event, fundraiser, this Sunday at Chapel by the Lake.
How many families are currently taking advantage of the system you set up?
We have not gotten to the point that we're hosting families yet. So we are still educating and talking with congregations. It takes churches a long time to make decisions, and that's okay. So I have been going to lots of council meetings. I am willing to go to any congregation that will have us present and talk about the program and talk with congregations about here's how you can host and open up your building to be part of filling in this gap for families. So we hope to have probably by summer or next fall to be ready to open the program. But that's pretty normal for this to take a year to 2 years to lay the groundwork so that once you open, it's stable.
So these people are currently already in Juneau. Have you thought about offering services and things that people need for refugees?
For refugees, like from international refugees?
Mm-hmm.
We haven't. You know, one of the things, I work a lot with food and housing, and one of the things is you kind of have to say, here's what we're going to work on. And we are going to work on helping the families in transition who are currently, you know, homeless in Juneau. And this is kind of what we can do with the resources we have. Are there bigger issues around housing and refugees that need to be addressed? Yes. But I realize our meetings are long enough. and so, you know, we're like, here's what we're going to work on and try to do it well. And we'll trust other people in the community to work on some of the other issues and challenges.
About how many churches are involved in the program?
So we have about 6 churches that are currently have either signed the agreement to host or are in the process of signing it. We need about 10 before we can open our doors.
What do they have to offer at a minimum?
They need to have a room, like a classroom that can be used for a week as a private space for a family. We can host about 3 to 4 families a week. So we're not talking about a huge, huge program. But we imagine this is about what Juneau would see come through. We're lucky up in the Matsu Valley, they've had a Family Promise affiliate for about 10 years. And so we've been in conversation with them about kind of what do you expect and what works out. Congregations provide a hot dinner, and we really encourage members to eat with families to provide that support and encouragement and stability. I mean, being without a home just throws everything into chaos. And so to have that warmth and companionship breaks through the isolation that being homeless can bring.
What if people can't make it down to the event this weekend?
If people can't make it down to the event, I am more than happy to field calls. They can call Shepherd of the Valley. We have a website that is familypromisejuneau.com, and folks can email or find contact numbers on that website. They can talk to it is not just Christian churches. It is an interfaith program, and so it is open to anyone who wants to be involved. In Juneau, it is predominantly churches who have buildings, but I have been in conversation with many of the other interfaith communities, encouraging them to be supporting congregations, and those are folks who help house and or help feed and talk with folks while they're at the church.
Can you share the phone number and website again, please?
I can. So the number at the church is 789-4093, and the website is familypromisejuneau.com.
Terry Stage Harvey, thank you for coming down, and thank you for the work that you're doing. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to add.
Well, just another reminder that we'll have the barbecue pork dinner at Chapel by the Lake this Sunday, 4:30 to 6:30. We're asking for a $10 donation.
Terry, thanks a lot.
Thanks to you.
The Juneau Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is a welcoming congregation embracing many different beliefs and invites the community to join them on Sundays at 10 a.m. at the Temple Sukkot Shalom on Cordova Street in Douglas. More information is at juuf.org. This message brought to you by the Juneau Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
It's about 32 minutes after the hour, and you are tuned to Juneau Afternoon here on KTOO and Karen Ann. On the phone with me now is Tom Brennan. He's the author of the book Dead Man's Dancer, The Michelle Linehan Story. Tom, thank you for coming on the station with us today.
Well, glad to be here, Jeff.
So, this concerns a story that happened in the mid-90s in the Anchorage area. Can you give us a brief summary of it, please?
Michelle Linehan was a dancer at the Great Alaskan Bush Company strip club here in town in Anchorage, and she was engaged to three guys simultaneously. And one of them turned up dead. He was found shot to death. And the investigation at the time turned up wasn't quite dry, but they couldn't prove, the investigators couldn't prove anything. And then 10 years later, a cold case squad came up with a possible solution to the case, and Michelle Linehan went to prison, and one of her other fiancés went to prison. And then later the case fell apart.
Is she still in prison?
No, she is free these days.
This story played in the press for months. What made it so gripping?
Well, it was just a fascinating case of a very attractive woman with a very bizarre story. And three fiancés simultaneously, and at times all three of them were living in the same house with her. They were all supporting her. She was making lots of money and dancing. Dancing away, and then eventually later on, she married a doctor and sort of became a community leader down in Washington State.
Now, I heard they took gullibility out of the dictionary, but how can these three guys be fiancés at the same time in the same apartment building?
Yeah, and I met her and spent a little bit of time with her and she and her husband, and she is very convincing. I'll say that she's not the kind of woman that that's just a drop dead knockout. She's attractive, but mainly she's a wonderful talker, and she's nice person to talk to, and she could talk to all of these guys, and she'd say, "Oh, don't worry about him, he's gay," you know, and she'd say the same thing to the other one about that one, you know.
What attracted you to the story?
I was assigned to it by my publisher, Epicenter Press, originally, and I just stuck with it, and Epicenter eventually published it.
What other kinds of research did you have to do?
An awful lot of interviews when I could, but an awful lot of it was going through the court records, because I didn't come in to the case until after, Michelle and John Carlin III, who was believed to be the shooter, were both in prison. And so I went through about 5,000 pages of testimony, court testimony, and actually came up with some very interesting things, I thought, in that that told a little bit different story than had come out in the court case, than had been presented by the investigator.
This is your fifth book. You wrote and rewrote the story five times. Why so many times?
Well, the story kept changing. When I first got into it, they were both in, the two people were in prison, and I just started working away. In fact, the title is my second title. My first title was,
That's okay. We all have those moments.
Yes, I'm having one.
Besides selling a lot of books, what's your goal for the book?
When you write a book, you just hope people will read it and enjoy it. And the people I know that have read it so far have had a very positive response to it. The story has been very widely publicized. It was covered by both NBC and CBS on their magazine shows. There's a CBS on their 60 Minute shows and NBC on their magazine show.
What are your thoughts about her guilt or innocence?
What was that question again?
What are your thoughts about her guilt or innocence?
Innocence would be kind of a strong word here. But I don't think she was the evil plotter that was portrayed by the judge either. Maybe it's just because it's hard to think of a person that you have sort of it's hard to say a positive opinion about, but when you meet her and talk to her and go away, you go away thinking, gee, she can't be that evil person. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, what's the status of the case now?
There is no case. What happened was, in the end, there was very little direct evidence. It was all circumstantial. And the two pieces of evidence that were most convincing fell apart. There was one piece was a letter that was written by the victim a week before he was killed. And he said, he wrote it to his parents and said, look, if I wind up dead, go after these people. And it was the other two fiancés and Michelle. And it said, make sure Michelle goes down. And then visit her in prison and be nice to her and tell her I loved her and all this stuff. So he sent that letter to his parents, and the parents got it after they were told that he was dead, and of course they were totally shocked, and they turned it over to the detectives that were investigating the case, and that was presented as evidence and accepted. And then the other piece of very convincing evidence was the son of the alleged shooter, John Carlin IV, who he testified three times, and each time he told a little bit different story. But he is the one who said that his dad was washing the murder weapon in the bathroom sink cleaning fluid to get fingerprints off it, and Michelle was standing in the bathroom door. That was one of his stories, and when the case was appealed, this was when Michelle was still in prison, her appeals lawyer argued that the letter was unacceptable because it was effectively testimony, and he couldn't be, and the writer of the letter couldn't be cross-examined because he was dead, and therefore the letter was unallowable. And so the judge says that's correct, so he threw it out.
So barring any deathbeds, confessions, is this, and this is the last we're going to hear of this, or is there another book in the making?
For this case?
Yes.
Not unless something happens. Right now, she is free, and there is. Well, oh, let me tell you the other piece that happened. When the judge in the case told both of the lawyers that they could, if they wanted, argue that John Carlin IV, the son of the alleged shooter, they could offer him as an alternate suspect. Neither one of them did, for various reasons. But when after she was released from prison and they dropped the charges against her, that son hired a lawyer, and the lawyer said, if my client is asked to testify again, he will plead the Fifth Amendment. And so then the prosecutor said, well, there's nowhere. They just said, we can't proceed anywhere from here. There is no case.
I've been talking with Tom Brennan, the author of the book Dead Man's Dancer, the Michelle Linehan story, published by Epicenter Press. Tom, I want to thank you for being on the show with me today.
Oh, I'm very glad to do it.
Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, not that I can think of. I mean, you know, you could talk about this thing forever, but, you know, you've got it pretty well, I think.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Great. Thank you very much.
This is Bird Note. Growing up, some of my best friends were salt marshes. I'd go in the early autumn dusk to watch the first ducks come south. Fleet green-winged teal and wary black ducks migrating from the Maritimes and Labrador. Some of the marshes are still there along the southern Connecticut shore, though more hemmed in now. Riding the train west to New Haven or New York, you pass them. They have old and evocative names. The Salt Pit, Great Harbor, Leet's Island, Old Quarry. From the train, you can see some of the marsh birds. Yellowlegs, sandpipers, snowy egrets. In the fall, if you're lucky, you'll find northern pintails with the black ducks and teal. With the high tides of spring, northbound flocks of widgeons touch down briefly in the flooded salt meadows of Leet's Island. We didn't take good care of many of these places. We diked and drained them. We filled them with broken concrete and tree stumps. We drove away their darkness and solitude with the lights of our nighttime houses. But some we brought back to life. Like Cove Island Sanctuary, not far from the railroad line in Stamford, where in recent years observers have recorded close to 300 species of birds. Passing through on the train, you get a brief, enticing view of the rich life of the marsh. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center. Now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Fall schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/diamond park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
About 13 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned to a Juno afternoon here on a great sunny afternoon. In the studio with me now This is Debbie Marriott and Jackie Triplett here to talk about the Empty Chairs Project, and now they're showing it to fifth grade classes in school district here. Thanks for coming down to the station.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you for inviting us.
So for people who aren't familiar with the Empty Chair Project, can you enlighten us, please?
Yes, I would like to. The Empty Chair Project is a project that's been going on for almost 3 years, and it basically came about by some 1958 Juno high school graduates that happened to find out that one of their students that they graduated with had been in a Japanese internment camp during 1944. So they started investigating it and started talking to other people and found out that several people, several families from Juneau were taken on a ship from Juneau in April of 1942, I believe, and taken to Seattle and then on to Minidoka, Idaho, where they were put in an internment camp for 3 years. And the city of Juneau was very upset to lose these people. One family owned the city cafe, which was the cafe in town where everybody had their special dinners and got together. It was the gathering place of the town. Another family owned the laundry. They were all good people, American citizens, and everyone was appalled that they were marched down to the dock with very little warning and taken away from us. So there were many people who wrote letters for them. They sent them gifts. They kept in contact with them. But just showing how the community came together, they also helped when they came back and were released. The community helped them restart their businesses, gave them credit, helped them re-enter Juneau back into their homes, and it was a very emotional thing for the entire town. So we have the empty chair represents John Tanaka, who in 1942 was the valedictorian of the senior class, but they tried to stop him from going, wanted him to graduate in May, but he wanted to go with his family. So he left in April, and they had a special graduation for him. But in May, when they had the graduation for all the other students, there was an empty chair on the stage, which represented John and all the families that were lost to Juneau that spring. And so this empty chair project, we raised money, we got a federal grant, and we have a bronze empty chair. It's a replica of a wooden chair that was used, and it's at the Fifth Street Capital City Park, and it's in the lower right-hand corner of the park as you look up the mountain. But from the chair, you can also see where the ship came in and took the families away from us. So what we're doing this week is we're fulfilling part of what we promised to do when the federal government gave us the grant to help us. We also had many people donate money towards this monument or memorial, basically. But we have to have an educational part of it so that people know why it's there and what has happened, and hopefully it'll never happen again to any ethnic group or any American citizen. And so on Thursday night at 7:30 at Egan Lecture Hall at UAS, there will be a showing of, well, not showing, a presentation of a living voice play done by a young actress that's coming in from California. And she will be telling the story of a family going to an internment camp. And it's multimedia, and the admission is free, so we're hoping a lot of people will come out and bring your students with you. We are also, on Friday, the fifth graders in Juneau have been invited to two schools in Juneau to also see this play, and the teachers have been given art kits and a curriculum that they are following up on, and each school will be doing it in a different way, the way that fits their school population, but hopefully we will invite people to come and see the monument at the park. It was installed a year before last, and there are interpretive signs there that will help, but it's a good place for a family to go. And today, Betty Myriad is with me, and Betty, she was interned with her family at Minidoka, and she has a story to tell about that and going back and visiting Minidoka.
I attended what was called the Minidoka Pilgrimage, and it is an annual event that has happened every year since 2003. And what this is, it's a three-day event, and there are keynote speakers and panels and small discussion groups that you can also break into. And so that goes on, and then the second day ended with a banquet, and then the third day with a picnic, which kind of relaxed everybody, and it was a fun time to get together with new and old friends. But it was a very meaningful event to attend, because one of the things is you ride a bus and you ride around the grounds where we had our internment camps. And these camps have Minidoka had about 44 blocks. Each block had a number of barracks in it in which we lived. And I lived in block 19, which had about 44 barracks in it. And each barrack had about 5 or 6 family units. And when we got there, there was a cots for us to sleep on, and a potbelly stove, and a light bulb hanging from the ceiling. And one of the first things we had to do was to fill our mattresses with hay. But anyway,
how old were you at this time?
I was 2 years old, two and a half. And I just turned 6 when we left Minidoka. I went to kindergarten in Minidoka and went back to Seattle. I'm originally from Seattle, so when the war was over, we went back to Seattle, and I started first grade in Seattle. But Minidoka is now a National Parks Monument, and it's called the Minidoka National Park Monument. And so it's your national park card will probably get you in. But it was a great way. These pilgrimages are a great way to honor our grandparents and parents. I mean, a lot of people are gone now, but for the ones who are still alive, it's a great way to honor them. And it's a great time for younger people to learn about this kind of a forgotten time of their Japanese heritage, because a lot of our parents didn't want to talk about it. It was just too painful. So, yeah. Anyway, it's the pilgrimage is something that we want to think about, because we don't want another Executive Order 9066 to send people to places like that in the guise of national security. Mm-hmm. So
these camps, the people who went to these camps were all from the west coast of the United States. And if you talk to any old-timers in Juneau, even here we were covering the windows with blankets and stuff at night, mm-hmm. because the whole west coast was closing down, worrying about Japanese invasion. So, and another thing I would like to mention is that Minidoka, when they were became this national park, they didn't realize any people from Alaska were there. And so all of a sudden they heard about our empty chair memorial, and they got very interested in us. And so this last summer, mm-hmm. they honored the Alaskans part of the story. And so we had several people go down from our committee, and mm-hmm. Betty was there also, and our committee had a panel discussion in front of all of the people who were there. And we also, the City Museum provided us with some wonderful things that they have had put in their display this a year ago when they had the display on the Empty Chair Project and the Japanese families from Juneau that were taken. And so that's very special. We've also won national arts awards for nonprofits. Greg Chaney has got some honorable mentions awards.
Oh, he did a great film.
On his film, and he's also been invited to Los Angeles to the, It's the National...
Japanese-American Museum.
Japanese-American Museum in April. So some of our committee members will be there with Greg to show his film there. And I do want to mention, if you go to the new library this week or probably for the next couple months, as you walk in, on the right-hand side, there are big two display cases. It's all about the Empty Chair and the Juneau Japanese families. Not only Juneau, there are Sitka and Petersburg families, the families in Southeast that were taken. One other thing that kind of rocked us all when we were finding out all this information, which keeps rolling in, that our art teacher, Art Lewis, was in the National Guard at the time. And we were told that he had to go and take some of the families down to the ship. And he said it was the worst day of his life. And that made us all emotional because he was a really fantastic man and a great teacher that we all had in high school. So this has been the emotional travel for all of us.
We're going to invite someone to come in tomorrow as well on the show to talk about the story. Anything you'd like to add? I forgot to ask you. Got about a minute to go.
Gee, I don't think you even got a word in, Wedge.
You are much more interesting.
Well, I do want to mention one thing. When 2 months after the war, Executive Order 9066 was given, which said that we had to go to a camp. And my family had 3 days to get ready to leave. And that meant disposing of all your things or storing them. And we were sent to temporary places in the Puyallup Fairgrounds, and that was ironically called Camp Harmony. And then from there we went to Minidoka.
And thanks so much for coming down to the station.
Thank you.
In Scotta Glen they lived a lot, and every Sunday after mass she would go and take a glass before good old bye bye.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like